top of the mountain, like people said. He said, if it had, it took the top of the mountain off. And he said, but you could see smoke coming from it. And he said, you know, it got hot around here for about 2 hours. He said, we had to take your shirt off. It was so hot, the air, just all around. He said, and then it cooled off. He said, I've never seen anything like it. And I said, well, I knew very little about it. So I said, well, what do folks say about it? He said, well, you know, there's some folks lived up there, he said, in a rowdy house. Well, it's a rowdy house now, he said, because people go up there with their girlfriends and stuff. He said, but back then there was a family in the house when this thing, and they said the thing landed and green men got out and walked around. So I said, well, were they, I mean, are they good people in the community? Were they truthful? I'm being kind of straightforward here, and I'm trying to nail this thing down a little bit. And he looked at me and he said, well, he said they like to talk a lot, you know. And I knew what he was telling me. And here he, you know, he's talking about a neighbor. He doesn't know me from anybody. But, you know, I'm not going to let him go, right? You know, being eager for the story. So I said, well, I mean, yeah, they talk, but were they known to be truthful? And he looked at me and he gave me the best answer Henry Kissinger could learn from this man. He looked at me and he said, well, you know, even a liar can see something. That leaves a lot of ground open for a lot of speculation. Jump in anywhere along here. I'm tending as moderator just to ramble on.
I have just something that I'd like to say. We were talking, we did seem to come to an agreement at lunch, the five of us. I think Mick was there. We seemed to all agree that, well, I don't consider this a storytelling context. I don't consider it a storytelling context at all. And it's a conflict I have with being a storyteller. I don't think performing stories is really telling stories. It's not the way people tell stories. They don't get up and perform when they tell stories. They simply, it's a low-key kind of thing, and it happens in the context of something else. It always has been that way. It's part of an evening. It's part of a gathering. But it's not, people don't get up and perform stories in context.
In the Celtic tradition, however, that's not necessarily... You know, I was looking recently at a kind of a cycle of storytelling. The first storytelling that was done first started with a chant, pretty much. Beginning of language. You find it a lot with Inuits up in northern Canada. There usually were chants that were set to some occupation, paddling a kayak or maybe working a loom, like the walking songs, okay? It was something that was chanted, and it was always in the first person. And it was usually a kind of a boastful, establishing that sense of person. You know, I am Kutak, a great hunter, great seal killer, great provider, okay? A little later on, then evolved the social kind of concept, and stories began to take on the third person, and then the search for the forces behind the phenomena of nature began. And then if you could explain why the storm came up, what lightning was, it was really the tongue of a snake. Then, if you knew there was a snake behind all that, then you could try to pray to the snake so that the lightning didn't hit you. You try to intercede. Well, some of the people that were particularly inventive, maybe somewhere in touch somehow, kind of pushed themselves in the foreground, and they became the storyteller. They were the ones that said, you know what that lightning is? That's a big snake. They weren't, I think, even trying, I think they believed that. But slowly the storyteller, I know in the Celtic tradition, did become a performer. His position was highly defined. In fact, in Wales, there's even a list of the things that he was granted by the king as part of his pay. So much linen from the queen, so much armor from the blacksmith. He had a chair at a certain place on the table, and he did entertain. And he told the hero sagas. But what's happened, I think, in America in the course of time, as Ruth Sawyer talks about this, a very, to me, an expert in storytelling, wrote a classic book called The Way of the Storyteller. She says, we are now back to where we are individually telling our own stories again. And we have completely gone a full circle. Just a concept.
Okay, I'm gonna say that the kind of stories where storytellers would get up and perform were kind of official stories. They were stories that would tell about tribal things, instead of national stories. In fact, Virgil recited his Aeneid to the Roman emperor. So that wasn't really the kind of story I was talking about. And often these things were sung, too. So that's something else. And it was a kind of official type of storytelling, the kind of storytelling you're talking about, where people would be employed to keep the history and the lineage of the king or a lord. But I'm talking about a more unofficial or not one who's preserving the great epics. I think it's important to remember for people, there's sort of a new occupation of storytellers developing in this country. And I think they're giving a very stagey, myself included, a very stagey appearance to storytelling that I don't think is a real good idea. I think it's good to keep storytelling low-key and not to become a television set, because that's American audiences tend to turn you into a television set when you start doing that. And I find that the more stage business that I do in my stories, the more people like it. But then I'm getting farther and farther away from I'm getting farther away from the storytelling that I get when I go out and collect storytelling. You can probably talk about that.
Well, I don't know.
We'll take questions in just 1 second.
Just a couple
here.
Of questions. The same sort of things starting to happen in Ireland too now with what are called here revival storytellers. And it's a sort of a new cultural development in many ways akin to the folk music revival in the 60s, and that people oftentimes from not within a particular tradition, maybe within or sometimes not, get very involved in it and very fascinated with aspects of it and turn into stage performers and employ a lot of the techniques of theatrical or dramatic presentation. And what happened with formal storytelling dying out in Ireland was that the context for it just disappeared. There were very intimate social contexts, houses which were known as houses for storytelling. I don't know if the same thing has happened in Scotland, Norman, the places that you, how much change has taken place there. And once the context went, and also in Ireland you had a situation where emigration drained an awful lot of the areas where the older traditional culture was surviving. In America, when the immigrants came over, there was really no context for the old style of storytelling. And also, the whole physical environment was different. In an urban setting, a lot of the belief systems that really underlie the whole storytelling tradition, I mean, even to tell a ghost story in the middle of North Chicago doesn't quite have the same impact as in the wilds of Connemara with the western wind whistling over the stone walls, you know, at 12 midnight. A lot of environmental factors. Also the fact that a lot of the needs, the psychological needs, even on a more kind of non-analytical level, the just general entertainment needs that storytelling fulfilled, are fulfilled now by mass culture, by popular culture, and a lot of the same themes keep coming. I mean, how many more car chases do we need to see? And yet people need to have the constant affirmation of the good guy winning out over the bad guy, which is about the most blatant form of social message you can ever have. I mean, it's out there in front. And a lot of the morality that was encoded and transmitted through folk tales, a lot of the things that I suppose you call socialization in any society, they're fulfilled by other needs now, by other means, and I think that's given rise to the revival, which in a very way is a very needed response to changing times.
I think that as a performer, as a fiddle player, when I was first starting to learn the fiddle, and I'd see somebody get up who could just a Liz Carroll or whatever, I couldn't pick the fiddle up for a while. Now it would eventually come to me again, and I'd get real inspired. But I mean, within the context of having seen someone who was just brilliant at the instrument play, I was intimidated. But yet, I'm finding when I tell stories, maybe I'm not such a great storyteller. But in the concerts that I do, and it's a wide range of things. This is very unusual for me. Most of my programs are schools, or a lot of Rotary clubs, a lot of church family nights where the whole family comes out together and so forth. When I finish storytelling, you know, and I bring to it, I just quit a job as a museum director to do this full time. So I'm bringing whatever I have to it, you know, which is all I have, sort of thing. And when I'm finished doing my performance, I'll have people come up to me and they just can't wait to tell me a story. There's a process in which somehow they're not intimidated. And as long as that's happening, I feel real good about it. I don't think that storytelling has to take this form. maybe a few of us going around are sparks and kind of poking people again to get them loosened up a little and get the stories coming out. Every time I sit at lunch over there, I mean, I'm kind of popular. I mean, that's not intentional, you know, but people come over and the stories start going. I heard a couple of great stories today. I picked up a new story from a woman about how her grandmother used to tell her that where violets came from. You know, where do you think violets came from? It was that piece of the sky they cut out to let the stars shine through. And they tried butterflies and some other things, and eventually it came to violets. But she told me just that much of it, and she said, now, I'm not exactly sure how the story goes, but I'll call my mom tonight, and long distance, mind you, and I'll give it to you tomorrow. Now, where's that impulse coming from? You know, and it has to come from someplace that somehow somebody's saying, Joe McHugh, he's the folk teller, or, you know, class director. He's a storyteller. It is somewhat artificial, but perhaps a response to a very artificial society in a lot of ways that maybe tries to compensate. I don't know. It's an interesting concept. I think what Jim is saying is very valid also. I saw a couple hands. Do we want to... Doug, you had a hand up, and then right behind you. Doug, you want to... Good point. Storytelling, too, in theater, I find, is real different. So theater traditionally has been a real interaction amongst the actors in the play, you know, in which the audience is really a very, you know, is separate from, you know, if we're going to be acting out some play that happened in the 30s, well, we're trying to really be there. We're trying to transform our characters. Storytelling, like the folk tellers, they never like to have the lights go all the way down. I do not like to perform with lights where I can't see the audience. It throws me completely. But that's very common in theater. You know, you want to black out the house. But in storytelling, you want to see the eyes. And I think you want to pick up on the mental imagery that people are getting. And in a middle story, sometimes I get these really incredible, like, creative impulses in a story. I mean, it's something I'd never thought in a story. Now, you could say that's haphazard. But I know, you can't convince me differently, that it's coming out of the audience and the magic of that moment. Sometimes, you know, this flight of fancy, and I just throw caution to the wind and pursue it. And the story then takes more depth and color and texture, and the longer I tell it, the better it gets. I appreciate audience. See, I couldn't do what I'm doing without audiences. I don't think you can learn storytelling in a car. Some of my friends do. I tried it. I'm going down the road, you know. Jackie Torrance got a great story. She used to try to tell a story of, she was working on a story of misery. The character in the main character story was Misery. Oh, Jackie Torrance, she's this kind of heavy-set black woman. She's just great. Most expressive storyteller I think I've ever met. I mean, physically expressive. She doesn't have to say a word, a look, those eyes darting back and forth, tell it all. Long fingers. Well, she's in the car and she's going, no, what's misery, you know? And she's got her CB on. She always runs it real low, just loud enough to hear on channel 9 or 19 or whatever. And she's going down, and these cars and trucks are passing her. And apparently this one big semi had passed her, and there was one more in the same company further back, and she heard coming over the radio, hey, you see that woman in that car you're about to pass? Think she's having a heart attack. You know? And it took her a while to figure out who they were talking about. You know, you can call state police. I never saw such a face. And she's misery, you know? Jackie says, now there's a good place to work on a story, but I can't do it. I don't know what it is. I have to put the tape on or just think about other things. I don't seem to be able to work on my stories real well. So the only other place to work on them is in performance. And I've been lucky enough to be like a resident artist for a year here and a year there with grants. So I do a lot with kids. And kids are, you know, they're helping me a lot because they'll, like the guy who wrote Babar, he said he loves kids because they'll go off on a dream with you. Just like that, because the line between what we call reality and the dream world, fantasy world, is very non-existent to children. And they're so ready. So I tell these stories, you know, and if it bombs, I'll know right away. They're a good audience. Ruth Sawyer says adult audiences are a lot easier to fool with the mediocre than children. I don't know about that. I wouldn't insult anybody. Go ahead.
It's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And wondering whether that in itself would prohibit the development of a storytelling culture, or whether it might enhance it so much.
Can I respond to that?
Sure can.
I'm working on a new book. I think I'm going to call it Shot for a Woodchuck. And I'm collecting real life experiences from people along the West Branch of the Susquehanna. My premise is that everybody has one or two really good stories to tell. And as they get older, these stories get better. And if you can get in the right context, or you can get people to tell you the story, the real storytellers are in this room. Everyone, it's almost like a natural human trait to tell stories. And I don't think you get good stories from literature. I think it's real hard to tell. I think it's real hard to take a story from literature and turn it into a tellable story. You're more likely to get a good story from your neighbor than you are from a book.
But what a tradition.
There is a tradition. We're hung up on European tradition. There is a tradition of American storytelling. It's very rich. And all you have to do is spend a week in hunting camp. Just go hunting. Spend a week in hunting camp. Right. Ken Thigpen at Penn State, good friend of mine. Just go on a canoe trip.
I think what you might be addressing too is something that people have talked a lot about, and I'm beginning to believe it. I think only now, right at this time, there is emerging in all aspects what might be a indigenous or a recognizable American folklore. Jazz is being played on in public radio seems like an awful lot, and being accepted in other countries, and this has been going on for some time, and I just think that there might be, in fact, an emerging American folklore. That's why my fascination with family stories, but I don't know yet on that one. But I'm finding out. I came across the best story I ever heard, okay? And it's a family story. And it really is the best story I ever heard. It's a very obvious story. It's not terribly clever. But the thing is, it happened. It really happened. And it's not some story that, although I love magic. I mean, did magic happen or not? Did the leprechauns come to the door? Yeah, they did. They did. But the story was from a doctor in Morgantown. And I could, you want to hear just a second? Just give you an idea, okay? And this doctor, he's my age, and his grandfather had gone through medical school and had paid his own way, and they were sharecroppers in South Carolina. And he had worked for the railroad during the day, or during the night, and he went to medical school in the day, and he got 3 hours of sleep a night. And for the rest of his life, even after he had made his money and was well respected and had a practice in Richmond, he never slept more than 3 hours. And he would doze. I love that, taking a little nap. I do that all the time now, but he'd doze in different places. You go to the ice house, you almost have to. But he said one time he went to see this black fella, and his name was Simmons, I believe, Joe Simmons. And he had just a single room in the bathroom down the hall in a tenement in Richmond. And the fella was way up in his maybe 90s. And he had congenital heart failure or a problem. And Doc Cease was his doctor, and he didn't receive a lot of pay for it. And it was just one of those kind of cases he picked up in the course of things, and he just did. And he would go see, and every once in a while, Joe would have to be hospitalized. And they'd notice whenever they'd hospitalized Joe that from his waist down, he was completely scarred. Completely. Because it had nothing really to do with the problem that Doc Cease was, he never asked him, never said anything about it, figured that wasn't his business. Well, one time he came over to Joe's house, and just to check on him. And everything in the room, if you can imagine, was very plain, very worn and used, and not worth much, as far as money. And he's in the room with Joe Simmons, and he looks over on the nightstand. And they're laying there, big, heavy, old Illinois railroad watch in a solid, in a 14-karat gold case, all engraved, key-wind kind of watch. And even then, this is a number of years ago, before the antique boom, they were very valuable. And it kind of just, jumped out at Doc C's because everything else in the room being what it was. And he looked at Joe and he said, you know, not to say anything like, I want to be paid or something. He says, you know, but he was amazed. Joe, where'd you get that? He said, that's a valuable watch. And Joe said, well, maybe it is. He said, but I'd never sell it. He said, there's nothing in this world I'd sell it for. And Doc C says, well, I hope you don't mind. Where'd you get it? And Joe said, well, that goes a long time ago. He said, I was about 18 when I came out of slavery. He said, and I was down south. He said, and after the war, he said, I came up to North Carolina and got a job on the railroad. It was about the only work that blacks could get. And he said, no matter how hard a worker you were or how conscientious, the highest you could rise in the hierarchy, as it were, was to fireman. You could never hope to be an engineer as a black man at those times, even after the war. Engineer was highly respected. You know, if you listen to the little ballads, they were gods. They were the American. See, that's the emerging folklore, I think. They were the American gods. These great machines. Old timers used to talk about hearing that, you know, sound of that whistle and knowing whose whistle it was by the pulls way down, miles away, you know, and these people hurtling down these tracks in these monster machines. And said, he went up pretty quick. He didn't drink and he really stayed to his job, and he was ambitious, and he was young enough when he came out of slavery that he wanted to make something of his life. And said he got to be fireman. And he said, and he'd been attached to a number of engines. He said, there was this one fellow, this engineer, and this fellow was way up in his 60s and real close to retirement. And he was just notorious amongst all the people that worked on the railroad, especially in the black community, as just being hell on blacks. Every time a black fireman was attached to his engine, he made life unlivable. He did everything he could until that man, without fail, either quit railroading or asked for a transfer, which usually meant some kind of demotion and a longer wait to get another engine as a fireman, see. And guess who old Joe gets, right? This old geezer, see. And Joe knows the fellow might be within a few months of retirement, and he's thinking, if I can just survive it, I just won't respond, no matter what he says to me, no matter what abuse he piles on me, and no one's going to step in the way and stop him. He's an engineer. It's the times. He said, I'll just put up with it. He said, but that fellow was just ingenious in what he could come up with. The things that he did, insult him in front of a bunch of people, you know, and just always treating him like he didn't know what he was doing. He'd been railroading for years and going on, and he came so close to quitting. He said, but he's just hanging on here. That old man's got to retire. He said, one day they were making a run from North Carolina, and they were going into South Carolina, and just about at the state line, they had a terrible derailment. Said that train just flopped over on its side, like an old turtle. And said that the steam pipes busted and steam got to spraying out all over that engine. And it just so happens that Joe, he was thrown clear when the train went over. And he was stunned. And he said when he was coming to, he didn't even hardly know where he was. And the first thing he heard was the sound of live steam. And he heard a scream. Said he never forgot it. Used to dream about it for years. His scream, he said. And he looked up, and that old engineer had gotten caught under one of them pipes and was being scalded to death. Well, he jumped up, never thought a thing about it, just instinct. Said he jumped up, grabbed the axe off the side of the engine, and went in there, and he busted those pipes loose and pulled that man out and saved his life. A few more seconds, and he'd have been gone. And in the course, he said, completely burned himself from the waist down. And he was hospitalized. And some representatives of the company came in and told him he did good, you know, and he was given a letter and things like that. And after a number of months, he was finally he got back on the job. He said the old man was gone. He'd been in the hospital for ages, and they retired him and everything. He said one day he was, now this is a true story. One day he was down in the jungle yards, you know, and he was working on some engine. And he said, and he looked down, and here comes that old man. He said he could spot his walk at a long distance, just the way that guy, you know, just, and he thought, oh no, he said, I don't want to talk to that fella. He said, I thought I was shut of him. So the fella walked up, never said a word to him. Walked up, reached out his hand, and gave him that pocket watch. Said it was his retirement watch. The railroad had given him. That's the story. Thank you very much for coming. I think we just got word. And Marshall's got a good story. If you all want to, talk to him a little bit, we might stick around here. I will for a few minutes. Would you kindly announce when you're done? Oh, there will be singing tonight. Oh, there will be singing tonight in the lounge of International Dorm. International's the real big one back up on the hill. And okay, singing on the Hallihurst mansion porch. Good night now. And tell stories.